From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, we've had many conversations on this show about mental health. Many people are experiencing increased anxiety and depression and other symptoms from the emotional shocks of the past year. For a small number of people, though, it seems their COVID-19 mental health problems are caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus itself, often for the first time in a patient's life. This rare outcome, known as post-COVID psychosis, seems to be linked to the virus's effects on the brain, even after patients have outwardly recovered. In a few minutes, we'll hear from psychiatrists about the emerging research on this new diagnosis. But first, I want to introduce someone whose family has had a heartbreaking experience with this. Jennifer Price is from Morris, Illinois. Earlier this year, she lost her husband, Ben Price. Ben was diagnosed with COVID-19. When he got home from a stay in the hospital for the illness, his personality and mental health had changed. Ultimately, he took his own life. Now, Jennifer is sharing Ben's story in the hopes of helping others. Jennifer, first, I'm so sorry for your loss, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. We really appreciate being able to continue to share our story and in hopes that it saves other people from going through this devastating loss.
I'm hoping you can begin by just telling us a little bit about Ben. Who was he? What was important to him in life?
Ben was one of those, and it's something all of his family and friends and everyone agrees with. He was just a larger than life person. The person that walked into a room had the most beautiful smile, engaging personality, and just was a wonderful person who lived life, you know, to the fullest and made sure that, you know, he was always doing something to help other people. He worked hard, but he was a very thoughtful and giving person and worked very hard. We own our own equipment, tractor and power equipment business, but then also he did farming on the side with crops and also cows and donkeys. And so just really lived life to the fullest.
And when was he first diagnosed with COVID-19?
He was first diagnosed February 12th. He had not been feeling well that week, but he had just gotten his first dose of the vaccine. So we thought maybe it was, you know, just needed a few days after that, like most of us. But come Friday, February 12th, one of his employees had tested positive. So we took the, you know, trip to immediate care, and sure enough, he had tested positive that day.
And what was the course of his illness like?
So he actually was very sick. He definitely struggled for a full week with very extreme oxygen issues. His lungs were pretty, you know, he was having a very hard time breathing, couldn't really do steps. He was quarantined in a room in our house. We have a son with disabilities. So, you know, we were trying to be very careful. And in the next week, he just wasn't getting better. So on February 18th, we got in to get the BAM infusion in hopes that that might just perk him up a little bit. And that just didn't seem to do much in 24 hours. So I had told him if that didn't help, we were definitely going to get him admitted, see if the remdesivir would help, which is the antiviral that is given as an inpatient. So we did that and admitted him then on Friday, February 19th.
And he spends, what is it, a week in the hospital? Is that
he was in for 5 days. So the remdesivir is usually around like a 5-day course. So he was getting that and improving. He wasn't intubated, but he was on supplemental oxygen. While he was in there, he also, his heart went into AFib, which is something that they're seeing with COVID patients. Fortunately, it was back into normal sinus rhythm within a day, you know, but just the whole experience in a COVID unit is unlike a typical hospital stay. You are completely isolated without anyone able to come and see you, obviously, but also just even staff. It's very hard to just pop in a room and turn a monitor. alarm off. They have to fully gown up and get all of the PPE on. And so it was very hard just when the monitors would be going off and nobody would be coming in. And so that alone, I think, is just another element of this COVID, you know, journey for so many, for hospital workers that have endured this the last year, and for patients who have been in these COVID units. It's definitely very, very difficult.
So Ben ultimately leaves the hospital. And when he comes home, when did you start to notice that his personality was different?
Yeah. So he got out on Tuesday, February 23rd. And of course, he was very weak and still having a hard time breathing. And he knew it was going to take some days to start physically feeling better. So the first few days, he really was doing well. He was just trying to rest. He would go out to his office and try to do just a little bit of paperwork or just go and check in with employees and then come home and rest. And by Thursday of that week, he just started getting more emotional about things and just not my husband's typical behavior. He's a very strong guy. He was a linebacker football player through college, just somebody who is very strong physically and emotionally. And he just started to be very, almost childlike in his demeanor. He was very quiet in his voice and was starting to get, in those next coming days, just very paranoid about his farm work, especially. He just kept saying how much he needed to get this farm work done. Now, mind you, it was February, so we were months away from doing any kind of farm work, but there was no getting him to understand that those were irrational thoughts.
And ultimately, what happened next, I guess?
Yeah. So by Friday night, he was starting to get worse and more paranoid. So I called his primary care doctor. And so they had prescribed an anti-anxiety medication. He started taking that and he thought it was helping a little bit. By Saturday afternoon, he was worse. My brother-in-law had spent the day with him just because he was so weak, and Ben wanted to go and do some farm chores and such. So my brother-in-law stayed with him. And again, it was the same thing. He was very worried about Ben because he was just not himself, and not just, okay, he's weak, or, you know, he's got to, you know, just get stronger. His whole demeanor was different. And, you know, we were all very worried. And so Saturday night, my daughter, who's 14, was, you know, they were best friends, Ben and his daughter, just absolutely best friends. And my son, who's 17 and has disabilities, you know, there was nothing that my husband loved more than being together with his family. So Saturday night, he was really struggling. So we decided to, I had my daughter stay home from a sleepover, and we made his favorite meal, and we just tried to, you know, just get him to a better place, because he was pacing the house. He was looking from window to window. He would sit in a chair with his hands over his face and, you know, just absolutely not himself. And we were trying so hard just to talk him through it and just kind of distract him and do something that, you know, all the things that he enjoyed. And we sat on the couch that night and just snuggled and tried to watch a movie with him. And finally, we were able to get him to just relax enough to fall asleep on the couch. And my daughter and I looked at each other just with so much relief, like, okay, his brain is finally relaxed for a moment. And we got him to sleep that night, and come Sunday morning, he woke up early, and I got up with him and made him a nice breakfast like I had been. We'd been doing all of the vitamins and a grape smoothie and a nice breakfast just to try and keep his strength up. And he was just going to head to the office for a few hours to do paperwork. And he had said, you know, this is the best I've felt. I slept good. And to me, in those moments, I was relieved and excited. And I texted his mom and sister immediately and said, you know, I think we've turned a corner. He said he slept better. He feels better. And, you know, it was only about 20 minutes before we had breakfast and he left. And my plan was to meet him out at the office. We had our donkeys and cows. I was going to do the chores for him while he did some paperwork. So that was the plan. And for whatever reason, before I left home, I decided to check Find My Friends on the phone and realized he was at our other farm property, which at the time wasn't a red flag. He hadn't been doing the farm chores. We had been having a lot of help and, you know, people jumping in to help us because he'd been so sick for a few weeks. So I called him and said, hey, you know, I see you're out at the other farm, you know, the cow's okay, everything looks good. And he was like, yep, everything looks good. The tone of his voice was great. He seemed fine. I said, okay, I'm heading out to the office. I will see you there in a few minutes. And he said, yep, I'll see you there. And within 20 minutes of that phone call, his dad had also been out just checking on the animals and was out at the farm and called me and said, I see his truck here, but I don't see him. And I'm like, well, maybe he's in the RTV out checking the pasture or the fences, you know, again, wasn't alarmed. And unfortunately, he called me within a minute and he had found him. And, you know, it was just absolutely shocking and devastating. And, you know, just still to this day, we just can't believe, you know, in those first moments, we really thought there was foul play. There was just no way, there was no way that he would take his life and leave his family. And when the police showed up, I just kept saying to them, you know, he wasn't himself. He hasn't been right. He's not been acting right since COVID. And, you know, was just explaining that. And within a few hours, you know, we were home and family and friends were coming over. And one of my friends called me and I was explaining the same thing to her that, you know, his entire demeanor changed. You know, it wasn't just my husband who was stressed or had anxiety with things, you know, like we all do in life. If you have things you need to get done and, you know, you're a little anxious, it wasn't that at all. He was a completely different person in the way he talked, his physical mannerisms and everything. And I was explaining this to her and she said, have you heard of COVID psychosis? And I was like, no, what is that? And so she immediately sent me 3 CDC articles and I read them immediately and knew exactly in that moment that that is what he had and that is what he was going through. And, you know, it gave us immediate clarity and also just some peace of mind to know, because in our hearts, we knew he would never have taken his life. He had just told a friend a few weeks prior, they were looking at a farm together and someone had taken their life there many years earlier. And Ben had said, you know, I know times can get tough for people and, you know, there can be great stress in life, but he said, you just can't ever do that to your family that way. And so his friend was adamant and wanted to hire a private investigator because he was adamant that it was not Ben who took his life. And, you know, what I just came to say to people was, you're right. You know, even though, yes, it was Ben who took his own life, it was not him. It was COVID that took his life. And, it, you know, he was robbed. And, you know, we just know with 100% certainty that it was COVID that took my husband's life.
Jennifer, I want to thank you again for sharing your family story. And again, say we are just so sorry for your loss. Listeners, if you're just joining us, this is The 21st. We're speaking with Jennifer Price from Morris, Illinois. We're talking about COVID psychosis, which is a rare form of psychosis that seems to be caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus itself. Jennifer's husband, Ben, is believed to have suffered from this, and as we just heard, ultimately took his own life. We need to take a break on the program. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with two psychiatrists. Dr. Dinesh Alam is psychiatrist and medical director from Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital, and Dr. Mason Chacko is a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Stony Brook University Hospital in New York. He's authored a case report on this. Was the lead author on a case report. It's called COVID-19-Induced Psychosis and Suicidal Behavior. Like I said, we need to take a break for our member stations. We're going to continue this important conversation. Listeners, we also want to invite you to join us. If you have a question for one of our guests, the number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Jennifer Price from Morris, Illinois. We're talking about COVID psychosis, which is a rare form of psychosis that seems to be caused by the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Jennifer's husband, Ben, is believed to have suffered from this and ultimately took his own life. I'd like to bring two more voices into the conversation now. Dr. Dinesh Alam is a psychiatrist and medical director of behavioral health at Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital. Dr. Alam, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'd also like to welcome Dr. Mason Chacko, clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Stony Brook University Hospital in New York. He's the first author on a case report published last year. It's called COVID-19-Induced Psychosis and Suicidal Behavior. Dr. Chacko, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Brian, for having me.
Dr. Alam, it seems among the conditions that follow a COVID infection, this one is quite rare. Do you know of patients who have experienced this?
Yes, we obviously provide hospital-based care, and we have seen a handful of cases. It is a diagnosis of exclusion, if you could imagine, because we have to rule out other causes before reaching the diagnosis of COVID psychosis. So yes. Very concerning when we do see patients with this condition. They present, with severe symptoms. One of the cases that I dealt with actually had gotten a gun and was threatening neighbors due to the paranoia. So it can lead to severe symptoms.
And Dr. Chacko, you published a case report on a patient. I mentioned that a moment ago. He was 52 years old, developed severe paranoia following COVID, and attempted suicide. What led you to suspect a connection between the virus and what was happening to this patient's mental health?
So, Brian, thank you, first of all, for having me on. And I just wanted to send my, condolences and our remorse to Jennifer, and we have her family in our thoughts here. So it all stems from the history and the timeline, piecing it together from the presentation that we had with our patient here in the hospital. And it was mostly putting that together was helping us to identify what could have been the certain triggers that led to his presentation here. And once again, it was during the peak of our crisis here in New York, when this was all going on.
Jennifer, can I ask you, had Ben experienced any psychotic episodes in the past before COVID? You said it seemed what you were saying earlier that he had not.
He had not. He had no history of mental illness or having any issues like that. So it was definitely way out of character for him.
And it sounds like you made this connection to the virus. You mentioned seeing a friend had sent a CDC report. Is that when you sort of began to think, well, maybe it was the virus itself that led to his illness?
Absolutely. And we knew, you know, once I looked up those articles and did a quick search, it was, you know, I know this is a rare effect that we're seeing, but it's happening more than people realize. And in addition to that, what they're obviously realizing is more people are severely impacted neurologically from COVID than, you know, they realize. So, you know, this is a really important discussion to be having, which is why I continue to share my story in hopes that there's action taken from the top in Washington, because we need to have these neurological experts on the task force. We need to come up with a plan for doctors. You know, when I had reached out to the doctors that had cared for my husband while he was in the hospital, they had not heard of this and they had been working in a COVID unit for a year. So, you know, a quick search and you can see this is, you know, this is happening all across the world, really. And, you know, the Mayo Clinic and there's many medical centers that are really, you know, starting to do some good research and studies on these neurological symptoms. And since I've shared my story, I just have gotten countless people that have reached out that have sadly gone through this very same thing. And I am talking every one of these cases. And it's women, it's men, it's older people, it's younger people. And, you know, everyone was the same. Nobody had a history of this prior to COVID. And so we have to be talking about this and taking action. And that's what I'm trying to do with sharing my story now is it's beyond sharing our story. It's, you know, we're helping save lives. We know that already just from educating people on this. Had I known that this term was out there, I would have known that my husband was dealing with something greater than just being a little bit foggy from COVID. I would have known to not let him out of my sight. And our plan was to come, you know, on Monday, we were going to go to the Mayo Clinic or go to somewhere in Chicago and find a better treatment course for him, because we knew what he was going through right now wasn't good and he wasn't getting better. But unfortunately we didn't make it to Monday.
Dr. Alam, can you talk about what are some of the hypotheses on what is causing this, how it's being caused, I guess, right? And that it is the virus itself and not just circumstances around the pandemic, you know, change in routine and stress and that sort of thing that so many people have experienced.
It's a great question. As Jennifer, you know, described so well, and thank you, Jennifer, for sharing this with the viewers. I think voices like yours are important to bring attention to mental illness, because I feel, and it's also generally agreed now, that the mental health footprint of this pandemic is going to be much larger than even the medical footprint. We are going to continue to experience the consequences of the pandemic for quite some time. In terms of what may be causing this, I think it is not new. We've known, about psychosis during a pandemic, back in the early 1900s with the flu epidemic. There were case reports of individuals with psychosis. We also know that, periods of stress lead to an increase in reports of psychosis. We know that, some medications that are used in treating this condition can increase the risk of psychosis. And, recently the postmortem studies have shown that the virus actually crosses the blood-brain barrier and gets into the brain and may contribute to changes that we see in conditions like schizophrenia, depression, etc.
And Dr. Chacko, your paper cites another study that looked at different past outbreaks, H1N1, Ebola, SARS, MERS, and found that people exposed to a virus during an epidemic or pandemic are much more likely to develop psychosis or psychotic symptoms than the general population. I think it was 1-4% compared to 0.015% in the general population. Can you talk about that connection? I don't know if you have anything to add to that, or is there anything that we know that might make people more susceptible?
Right, exactly like you had just mentioned, between 1-4% of patients exposed to a virus during an epidemic pandemic develop a psychosis or develop some form of underlying psychotic symptoms. The first signs of COVID-19 and psychosis was first observed in China in January of 2020, because they were just on the downside of the curve. And they had three similar cases, similar to what the case report that we wrote about. And in their three cases, their patients presented. And once again, these patients did not have a known prior psychiatric history at that time, but they displayed extreme anxiety, agitation, auditory hallucinations, visual hallucinations, and the suicidal ideations. And then they were seen and followed up in their clinic. So I think that once again, with psychosis, if we're talking from a general psychiatric standpoint, the age that we're seeing that these patients with COVID psychosis coming into play are also much later on in terms of age factors. You know, we were seeing them more so in their 40s and 50s, late 30s, 40s and 50s, which was similar to our patient that we wrote about. And like Dr. Alam was speaking to, I think a lot of it speaks to this neuroinflammation that's leading to this brain fog that we keep talking about. And it's that's what we're seeing, and we were attributing most of this to.
Dr. Alam, what would you say to patients out there and their family? We heard Jennifer say a little while ago that if she would have known about this, she might have tried a different course of treatment, that this was a possibility. Dr. Alam, what advice do you have for people who maybe their, you know, physicians are overworked right now, not all of them read every journal article, if they feel like they're not getting, the sort of attention they need, like how do they go about trying to sort of raise the alarm for their, you know, on behalf of their family member?
I think really the good news is that the treatments we have currently are effective. And so my message would be get help, treatment works. And I think the mental health providers are now more familiar with what's going on. And I think, you know, early identification and treatment is really the way to go.
And Dr. Chacko, I wonder if, taking a step back from this, what is this, you know, still somewhat mysterious long haul symptom, I guess not so mysterious if you're talking about what's happened in past pandemics, but what does that tell us about what we know and don't know about SARS-CoV-2 and coronavirus disease and the, you know, so-called long haul or long COVID effects of this pandemic?
So since the pandemic now has been going on for the last year and a half here with us in the States, we are beginning to learn each and every day new information about this virus. And as within the past 6 to 7 months, we are now learning about these neuropsychiatric manifestations, which are going to be more so now that I'm seeing in the hospital. I'm a CL, a consultation attending here in the hospital, and we consult on these patients. But part of the second surge, we're seeing more and more neuropsychiatric sequelae from these patients as well. I think every day there needs to be a conversation that's ongoing and discussion whether it's through case reports, other forms of publications, research, open dialogue, like what Jennifer is trying to do is trying to promote awareness, because I think there's so much that still needs to be learned about this for the future. And I think many institutions are trying to do this. We here at Stony Brook are trying to create post-COVID clinics to follow these patients. There are studies that are going to be going on looking at MRI imaging and following these patients forward to look at their inflammation. So I think that there needs to be a collaborative effort amongst, it's just not physicians, providers, but it needs to be a multi-layered approach to this.
Jennifer Price, I wonder, what is your final message to others now when it comes to COVID psychosis or who may have a family member who is dealing with this or something like this?
Thank you. You know, I think like Dr. Chacko said, we have to connect these dots. There's a lot of medical centers, and my local neurologist here, Dr. Mezzo, immediately after he heard our story, held a clinical with the hospital and explained to people, even though he hadn't treated my husband, he knew to tell everyone this is real, this is what to look for. And I've been sending him patients all the time that reach out to me saying they aren't feeling well. He gets them in directly. And with him and then my state representative, David Welter, I've met with the governor, and we're working on just even within Illinois to start formulating a plan so that people know what to look for, that medical centers know, you know, when they're doing discharge papers or if you have a positive COVID test, you have to get a text every day and sign off, you know, I don't have a fever, you know, and all of these things. And we can very easily add the mental health questions on there, you know, just are you feeling okay? Or, you know, having an opportunity, if you have a family member that you realize isn't acting right, where do you go? But the hospitals and doctors need to be educated to know if a patient comes to them, what should they do? You know, it's not just regular, typical anxiety, like we discussed. This is because of a virus and an infiltration in the brain. So those are very key things where that's why I'm working with Washington, and I've met with my congressman in Washington via Zoom to see what we can do, you know, from that level, because it has to be something that we can take and have as a best practice across the nation so that everybody's prepared and knows what to look for and what treatments are working. You know, like Dr. Alum said, he's, you know, there are treatments that are working. So if he found something that's working, we need to then be able to get this out to other physicians so that they can try and understand what might work. And so it's important for us to continue to share our story and to, you know, just keep my husband's legacy alive. We started a foundation and we have a website for him called Live in Hope, the number 4, benprice.org. And right now we're compiling kind of all of the interviews and stuff that I'm doing, but also starting to do, he did a lot of giving back to the community through time and money. And so we're putting things together that we can continue that in his honor and memory. And, you know, we just miss him every moment of every day. And we just want to continue to live in hope for Ben and, you know, try to help other people so they don't have to go through this.
Jennifer Price, I want to thank you again for sharing your family story and again offer our condolences to you and your family. And thank you for being here today. I also want to thank Dr. Dinesh Alum, psychiatrist and medical director of behavioral health at Northwestern Medicine Central DuPage Hospital, and Dr. Mason Chacko, clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Stony Brook University Hospital in New York. Thank you all for being here. This is The 21st.